You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
During the Revolutionary War, the Continental Army recruited young women to work as cooks and maids at British campsites, where they could eavesdrop on conversations about troop movements without raising suspicions. Women spies continue to serve their country, and today there are more women working in the CIA than ever before. Abigail Jones recently interviewed a number of them, and they're the subject of her article, Women of the CIA, The Hidden History of American Spycraft, which was a cover story of the September 20th edition of Newsweek magazine. I'm very pleased to welcome Abigail Jones to our show today. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Did you have any problem getting the CIA to grant you access to their female employees?
Well, I'll put it this way. I've never spent so long trying to make a story happen as I spent on this story. I first approached the CIA in the summer of 2015, and I finally showed up at their doorstep about 9 months later.
And did they insist on redacting the article?
No, I made it very clear from the beginning that they would not be able to see a draft of the article. What I did agree to, and I wanted to agree to this, was to fact check the details of the women's biographies with respect to their work. Half the women I interviewed are undercover, so there's a lot of sensitivity that went into describing their work in a safe way.
And so some of them you just given names, first names, and in many cases they wouldn't tell you anything.
Exactly. There came a point in my interviews where so many women had answered a question about, can you tell me more about what you do every day, with the same analogy, which was, imagine you're doing an 1,000-word jigsaw puzzle, but you only have 200, I'm sorry, an 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle with only 200 of the pieces, but the fate of some major event is resting on figuring out what the picture is. I got that answer so many times that my contact at the CIA piped up that they don't coordinate answers.
Was the CIA concerned that you might be a conspiracy theorist? Didn't they have to confirm that you weren't, although a CIA employee removed the batteries from your recorder after every interview?
Yes. When I walked into the lobby, I came with three recorders because I never trust just one. I actually had my iPhone. I didn't know I wasn't allowed to bring it in. I had planned on trying to take a few photos in the lobby and was quickly informed that, number one, I had to dump out all the batteries of all my recorders into a Ziploc bag, not only at that moment, but after every interview. And in between the interviews, I handed that back over to one of the women who sat in.
And why? You couldn't do any keep secret messages in the batteries. It was just a matter of preventing you from doing more interviews than they wanted you to conduct?
You know, I think that they wanted to make sure they were aware of not only what devices I was bringing in, but what I was doing with them. They didn't want me, I assume, they never told me this, but this is what I gathered. They didn't want me secretly doing an interview with someone, taping something I wasn't supposed to be taping. One of the interviews I did with Gina Bennett was over lunch in this actually quite lovely lunchroom at the CIA, but I couldn't record in there because we were in a public space. So they were on me, you know, to make sure everything was just so.
In the old days, a reporter just would have taken notes.
Well, I did that.
How many women did you wind up interviewing altogether?
So the CIA gave me access to seven women who are currently working at the agency. And then I reached out to, I think, two or three women who are former CIA officers, and I interviewed them as well.
If you met any of these women socially, would you be surprised to discover that they were working as spies?
Every single one of them. Every single one. The way I put it best is, you know, if you're sitting in the subway in New York City going somewhere and you look up at the family sitting across from you who seem like the most unremarkable group of people, that mom or dad could definitely be in the CIA.
Now, I get a sense that it was easier for women to succeed in the World War II era Office of Strategic Services that preceded the CIA.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, so women have long played a critical role in the CIA and in the OSS, its predecessor organization. There were a few favorite stories of mine that I unearthed while reporting this story. One is about a woman named Virginia Hall. She organized sabotage operations across France. She helped POWs to safety, all while disguised as an elderly farmhand And she also had a prosthetic leg that she nicknamed Cuthbert. And the Gestapo reportedly considered her the most dangerous of all Allied spies.
But she escaped the Nazis by crossing the Pyrenees on foot, despite that leg.
Exactly, exactly. Another favorite story that I wrote about was a woman named Eloise Page. She started her career as a secretary in the OSS, but she ended it as the third highest ranking officer in the Directorate of Operations. She was also the first female case officer, the first female station chief, which is the highest ranking position for case officers abroad. And one of my favorite details about her, I came across in the Washington Post obituary, where they described her as this lovely Southern belle who wore white gloves, she wore dresses, never pants, and she taught Sunday school. But for me, the most telling part of that obituary was the last sentence, which stated that she left no immediate survivors. And I think, for me, that really got to the heart of what women back in the OSS and today in the CIA are facing, which is, how do you do both? How do you rise at an institution that is tasked with protecting the country at a place that's probably one of the oldest boys' clubs in America, and simultaneously have a personal life?
And have kids. And a few of them you spoke to did have kids.
Yes, yes. I spoke with two women who are single mothers. I spoke with women who are married and have kids. And I spoke with women who are not married.
And did the CIA allow them to take time off to be moms, especially after they gave birth?
They did.
They gave maternity leave?
Yes, all the women I interviewed did take time off. It's a conflicting answer, to be honest. They all said, I took time off. But most of them said, well, I was back in the office with my newborn X number of weeks after giving birth because I needed to lend my expertise to this crisis. Women told stories about giving briefings right after giving birth, taking phone calls in the middle of labor. You get a sense that there's the duty. They want to do the work. They feel this sacrifice is worth it, but at the same time, they're brushing up against a reality where it's really hard to do both.
My guest is Abigail Jones, whose article, Women of the CIA, The Hidden History of American Spycraft, was a cover story for Newsweek magazine's September 20th issue. Perhaps the most famous woman to work for the OSS was Julia Child. Didn't she work for General William Donovan, the head of the OSS?
She did, before she brought French cooking into all American homes.
But she wasn't hiding any microfilm inside of a cake?
I mean, who knows? Who knows what the secrets were inside of her apple pies? But she also met her husband at the OSS. He was an officer there. I think it's a little known fact. It's important that before she became this legendary woman of domesticity, she worked for the OSS.
You write that women today make up close to one half of the CIA workforce and one third of senior leadership. But yet you still think that they're underrepresented.
Yeah. So according to a recent report that the CIA put out, women are 45% of the CIA workforce and 34% of senior leadership. Those are good numbers. The problem is that women don't have that same level of representation at the top. So according to the report, in 2012, 19% of officers promoted to executive level jobs were women. And that's down from 30% in previous years. The report also found that women were much more likely to decline high profile assignments because of their long, unpredictable hours. But these high-profile assignments are critical to making that leap to a higher position.
So is there a real split between the operatives who travel and do what's considered dangerous work and the analysts who mostly work on their computers?
Huge, huge difference. So you think about clandestine ops, the kind of, from the Hollywood version, the James Bonds, the Jason Bournes, who are going abroad, living overseas, moving every 2 or 3 years. Think about the challenge of being a woman in that role. First, you're one of the only women there. It's much, much more dominated by men. Second, you're going out at night. You have an undercover identity. You're doing a cover job during the day. It's very difficult to meet people. It's difficult to have a family and do that work.
On the other hand, since when we picture a spy, most of us don't think of a woman, couldn't that be seen as an advantage?
Absolutely. So a great story came to me through a woman named Janine Bruckner. She joined the CIA in the late 1960s. She said at that time the CIA funneled women into the analyst track. She didn't want to be an analyst. She wanted to go overseas. She wanted to recruit agents for the CIA. So she said, I think I'm remembering the numbers correctly, there were about 66 people in her training course. She was one of six women. And when she got her first job as a case officer somewhere in Asia, she couldn't say which country, her boss saddled her with all this paperwork, kind of quote-unquote ridiculous paperwork. That wasn't her job. She was there to be a case officer, to go out into the field. So she said to me, in my free time, I went out and met people. I met everyone that I could. And she said, and I'm quoting her, I was in my 20s, this little blonde woman. No one suspected who I worked for. And when that boss left and she got a new boss, she said she was fed up. She was close to quitting. She couldn't do it anymore if they weren't going to let her do her job. But first she wrote up a list of the contacts that she had made on her own time and the information they had access to. She gave it to her new boss. He was impressed. She said that was a tipping point in her career, that he didn't care that she was a woman. He cared that she did a good job, and he's the one who wrote back to headquarters and, according to her, made sure everybody knew about her.
On the other hand, after she worked 24 years at the agency, Janine Bruckner was accused by her subordinate officers of being an alcoholic who sexually harassed men and wore provocative clothing.
Yes.
And she wound up suing the agency and winning?
She did. So by that time, think about this. Janine Bruckner has been at the CIA for about 24 years. She's infiltrated the Communist Party. She has turned a Soviet bloc agent. She became one of the first female station chiefs. And then soon after, she reported her deputy for physically abusing his wife. She finds out that he and a small group of other direct reports to Janine leveled these accusations on her, and the CIA believed them. So she sued the agency, and a couple years later, she actually won her suit.
$410,000.
Right.
Not a lot, but still.
It was something.
And now she's a lawyer who specializes in cases against the CIA and other federal agencies.
Exactly. She's kind of the CIA's worst nightmare, you might say.
Has she won any big cases for others?
She's won big cases. She was involved in a case, I think it was in the late 90s or 2000s. A group of women sued the agency because they claimed that they, as women, were being treated unfairly with respect to a rule about relationships with foreign nationals. Men were getting away with it, and the women weren't.
When you say relations with foreign nationals,
so
comes to mind, no?
Yeah, yeah. So you're dating someone, you want to marry someone, or it doesn't really matter. Her point to me was, regardless of the definition of the relationship, the men were getting away with it. They were getting a pass, and the women weren't. And that's something that she saw systematically throughout her entire career. She said that at every turn, no matter how well she did at the last opportunity, she had to start again at ground zero. She had to prove herself all over again because she was a woman.
Isn't it difficult for a CIA agent to date if she can't talk about her work?
It is. I was fascinated by that issue, and I asked that question to the women many different times. I never really felt fully satisfied with the answer, and maybe that's why it's actually hard for them to meet people. I said, let's say you're single and you go out on some dates, you're at a bar with some friends and you meet someone. How do you talk about what you do? And I got a lot of answers like, well, you just say you work a desk, or you say your job's boring. And they said eventually people would accept it. Now, if I was out dating a guy and he told me that, maybe this is because I'm a journalist, it's my job to ask questions, but there's no way I would go out with someone for a year and all I'd know about their job was they worked at desk.
So do they marry other CIA agents? Valerie Plame married an ambassador, but could they talk openly about what they did?
Well, I don't know what Valerie and her husband personally talk about, but...
Well, you talked to Valerie.
I did, but it is a lot easier for people in the CIA to meet and marry fellow officers. Valerie had a really interesting insight that I wanted to mention. So she was in the clandestine arm, and she said about many of the women that she worked with, I'm quoting her here, They were smart and ambitious and funny. But to be very honest, they had stepchildren. They had not raised their own children, or they were divorced, or they went home to cats. They had really paid a personal price. Many of the women I interviewed who are married met their spouses within the agency or at another alphabet agency. It wasn't someone from outside. It makes it easier to have that comfort level of you can't talk about certain things, or you feel like you're in a trusted space where you can actually say where you work.
In Valerie's case, you did have twins.
Yes, yes. There's another, like Valerie, another woman I interviewed whose husband was a spy, Suzanne Matthews, and they traveled around together as a tandem couple, married spies. And they raised two kids while doing this, moving every 2 or 3 years.
Did their kids know?
So...
It's like the Americans.
Right.
I don't know if you've seen that show.
Oh, no, I brought that up with a lot of the women. They actually, the Americans seems to me, in my very small poll of women at the agency, the one show that gets some of it right with respect to spycraft and how they dig into the effect that this work has on families and on raising children. Of course, The Americans is about KGB spies, so they all said, don't put that in the article. And I didn't. But Suzanne Matthews and her husband raised their kids, you know, while working as spies abroad. And she said, there are so many benefits to that. Your children are exposed to so many cultures, all those that, you know, can just list everything. But at the same time, there were moments when their life was very tumultuous and, in fact, dangerous. And there were times when they were living in an unstable Balkan country. She couldn't say which one. And her husband was the chief of station, and he was a target. And they had guards. They had to check their car every morning for bombs. And their children would always ask, who are those men? Why do they what are they holding underneath our car? And she would tell her kids that there were a lot of stray cats in the area. They had to check the car every morning to make sure no little cats or kittens had crawled in there and fallen asleep before they left in the morning for school.
My guest is Abigail Jones, a writer and editor at Newsweek magazine, and her cover story for the September 20th issue of the magazine is Women of the CIA, the Hidden History of American Spycraft. We'll continue our conversation after this. We are back with a look at the women of the CIA with Abigail Jones. Her article was the cover story of the September 20th issue of Newsweek magazine, Women of the CIA, The Hidden History of American Spycraft. We learned the name of Valerie Plame when her identity was leaked to the press as part of a political action. And she said, she's been on the show, she said that her friends in the D.C. area were totally unaware that she worked at the CIA, and she had to pay a price for that.
Yeah.
In fact, I assume all of these women, the men as well, have to pay a price for keeping their what they do for a living secret from everybody.
They do, men and women. I think that's a really good point. My Newsweek piece focused on women, and so... That price was different for each of the women that I interviewed. Abby is a great example, and that's a pseudonym. I can't say her full name because she's undercover.
To this day,
right. She is the first...
And Dick Cheney doesn't know about her.
Let's hope not. She's the first-generation naturalized female case officer from a certain South Asian country. I can't say which one. And when I asked why... I got a very strong answer that said if you printed what country, it could jeopardize her safety and the safety of her family.
She's a Muslim American.
She is.
But does her family know much about what she does?
She said that they know a bit more now, but she's been working for the CIA for decades. It's been a long time. And she said that when she first joined the CIA, she felt she finally made it. I'm in. I'm here. I've succeeded as this Muslim American woman, but I can't tell anyone. And that was a great weight on her. But to your point about the costs, that's one type of cost. But for Abby, there's something more. She works in the Directorate of Operations. So she was overseas for many, many years. She recruited dozens and dozens of spies. But that's a job that doesn't lend itself very well to getting out, meeting a partner, or just having a personal life, making friends. You know, it's not all about just getting married and having children. And she said, I asked her, well, do you mind? Like, is it worth it for you? And the smile that spread across her face was truly, it was beautiful. She looked at me and she said, are most of my male colleagues married with kids? Yeah. Am I here late most nights? Absolutely. But she looked me straight in the eyes and she said, but the work is delicious. And that was her word. But despite that, she still said, I still have to face the fact that at the end of the day, I'm coming home and I'm alone. My fellow ops, you know, female ops officers, we all own cars. We have beautiful homes. We have nice things. We have truly succeeded. If you look at the bar for women and success today, they are there. But she said, I'm still accepting the fact that it's just me.
We're talking about personal costs, but what about the cost of the CIA? Can it achieve a global perspective if all of its employees are white men?
Absolutely not. And the CIA is aware of that. In the report I mentioned earlier on women and in a separate report on diversity, both have come out in the last handful of years, they've stated point blank, we know we have these problems.
But they're less diverse now than they were just a few years ago.
That's true. So while
why?
I think part of the problem is, according to the women I interviewed, there's still such a dominant mindset of white men. White men are the ones in positions of power. And if you look at the numbers, there was an increase in African American officers reaching the highest rungs of the organization between 1984 and 2004. But that progress has reversed in the last 10 years. One of the women I interviewed, a woman named Sarah, a pseudonym, is a single mom. She's a black woman, and she works in the male-dominated weapons and space analysis area. And she talked about how she has noticed in the last, I think she's been there for about 20 or so years. In her time there, she has noticed diversity and inclusion shifting based on who is running the organization. She felt it was better than when she started, and it's not as good as it today as it was then. So it really goes to who's at the top and the type of precedent that they're setting.
How much of it is also a matter of recruitment?
That's a great point. Recruitment is critical. And I should add that it definitely, to burst all of your bubbles, no one's out there watching you for 20 years and then tapping you on the shoulder and saying, okay, we're ready for you now. Most of the women who I interviewed found out about the CIA because there was a flyer posted in college or grad school. They simply applied, or they got there through another job in the government. I think recruitment's really critical. But another woman I interviewed, Maya Lanis, who was the first woman to hold 6 different leadership positions at the agency. She's currently the deputy CFO, but before that, she was the chief of the Diversity and Inclusion Office, and she gave me a fantastic quote that speaks to this issue. She said, I gotta say, running diversity and inclusion was a really hard job. I like to say, somewhat jokingly, but not really, that protecting America from weapons of mass destruction was easier than leading diversity and inclusion.
I'm speaking with Abigail Jones. Her article, Women of the CIA, The Hidden History of American Spycraft, was the cover story of the September 20th edition of Newsweek magazine. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Maya Lanis also talked about having an accommodating husband. Her husband was willing to scale back on his own career in order to help out at home.
That's right. And she acknowledged how rare that is.
But it wouldn't be all that different from women executives at top positions at major corporations, even though there aren't all that many.
Exactly. What women are dealing with at the CIA is no different from what women are dealing with in probably every other profession that we have today. What I think is different is, number one, the weight of the work that they do. So I am a working mom. I have a baby at home. And every day you're kind of constantly trying to figure out how to make it all work with my husband. We're juggling a million things professionally and with family. But my job isn't the safety of the country. My job isn't when one bomb has gone off, I have an hour to make sure we find the other one. That's what these women do. And I think the weight of that propels them to focus even more and prioritize even more on their work. That level of sacrifice is something that I think you can't possibly know unless you're in it. And that's where, for Maya, it made all the difference for her husband to say, I'm going to be the one to put my career on the back burner and to help out at home so you can pursue your career wholeheartedly. And she has had incredible, incredible positions. She was the first female chief of the National Counterproliferation Center, which is responsible for combating the spread of chemical and nuclear weapons. She was the first female chief of WINPAC, the Weapons Intelligence Nonproliferation and Arms Control Center, which protects the country from the strategic threat of foreign weapons. But she tells a great story. When her daughter was young, she was unfortunately diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. And she said this threw her family into a tumultuous time. She was heading up a major, major group. She couldn't tell me which one, but it could have been one of those two I mentioned. Her daughter had countless doctor appointments. And not only that, her daughter was at an age where she said school trips were everything, and there were a lot of school trips, but the school wouldn't let her daughter attend them without a parent present. And Maya said that she was able to make it work. She attended every doctor appointment, and she would get into the office one morning, and they'd be reviewing with her team, okay, we have to do this, 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 this. All these things are due. She said, okay, but at 2 o'clock, I'm going to the zoo. So there are ways to make it work, but like I said before, it's different for each woman depending on the variables in her life.
We were talking about diversity. Tracy Ballard was the first CIA officer to come out as gay and not get fired for it. In the past, there was fear that if you were gay, usually, I guess, males were gay, they could be blackmailed, and that's why the agency didn't believe it. And it so have attitudes about homosexuality changing affected the way the CIA looks upon homosexuality?
Absolutely. So Tracy said that the CIA has come leaps and bounds from when she first joined. She came out in the 80s when it was illegal to be gay at the CIA. As you said, the fear was that if some other country kidnapped you, got access to you, they could blackmail you for information at the risk of being outed to the CIA. And every officer, when they join the agency, goes through a polygraph test. And that is where Tracy decided to come out. She had a young daughter at home. And she said, I couldn't do it anymore. I couldn't raise my daughter to be a strong woman who believed she could do anything if I was leading two double lives. She was not only leading a double life at home because she couldn't tell anyone where she worked. She was leading a double life at work because she wasn't being her true self. And when she came out, she was under investigation for a year and a half. She said it was one of the worst times in her professional career. She almost left the agency many times. But in the end, she was able to stay. She was the first officer to come out and not get fired. And she said deciding to stay was the most important decision she made because it meant she could affect change from the inside. And in fact, she later helped to found the CIA's Agency Network of Gay and Lesbian Employees, ANGLE, which plays a very important role in the CIA and in other government agencies as well.
How do they look upon films and television shows about the CIA? Claire Danes, when she was in Homeland, was sleeping with other spies. It's generally societally, we assume that male spies, James Bond can sleep with as many women as he wants, but if a woman sleeps with men to get information, then she is a slut or something. And that was an issue that Claire Danes' character had to deal with in Homeland. Did these women talk about that?
Yes, it came up all the time. I think Hollywood perpetuates two very conflicting myths about the CIA. On the one hand, you have the Jason Bournes, the James Bonds, who are leaping from trains, women are prizes, and it's this really macho male world. On the flip side, you have these sexy bombshell women who are stabbing by day and seducing by night on behalf of American spycraft. Neither is true. Claire Danes, Carrie Matheson character, is portrayed as this hyper-intelligent basket case. She sleeps with her assets. There's a show, I think it was called State of Affairs. Katherine Heigl mm-hmm. played a CIA agent. I asked one of the women about that show, and I think this is a direct quote from her. She said, that character is doing too many jobs and sleeping with all of her assets. Seriously, who has the time?
How did they take Zero Dark Thirty, which is a film that's come under a lot of criticism for the way it depicted CIA activities?
I asked about that often, actually, and I think, to be frank, I think they were hesitant to respond. And I don't know if that was a CIA agenda or the women just simply didn't want to respond. But Zero Dark Thirty is, well, certainly based on real events. And
directed by a woman.
Yes. And it doesn't perpetuate this myth of kind of the sexy, like tight skirt, mini dress kind of woman. It's still a Hollywood version of what happens. And I think that what these women show is that whether you're a single mom of five, like Gina Bennett, terrorism analyst, whether you're a married mother of two, as the, you know, having been the first woman to hold six different leadership positions, whether you are a gay mother, whether you are a single mom, whether you're not married at all, there is a place for you and you have a critical role.
Before you go, I just want to mention that you interviewed an explosive expert and a nuclear expert who couldn't describe their work in any detail. And then one woman who you asked if she travels for work replied, "Different people travel differently." They have to think cryptically.
It's my job to ask questions, and it's my job to know how to ask questions differently to get different answers out of people. I've never had so much trouble with certain questions in my life than interviewing women at the CIA.
Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you for having me.
Abigail Jones' article, "Women of the CIA, The Hidden History of American Spycraft," was the cover story of the September 20th edition of Newsweek magazine.